It's the Thursday Minnesota News on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up on the podcast, a U.S. Senate candidate touts her conservative credentials. The freshman on the Minneapolis City Council learned the ropes. The Green Line brings development. We hear about a family feud within Target. And can the measles vaccine destroy cancer cells? First, Minnesota Congressman Tim Walz says Minnesota Veterans Affairs officials say they don't underreport waiting lists. Walz met with them yesterday following allegations the VA in Phoenix misrepresents wait times. Mark Zedeklik reports.
Walz is a member of the House committee that oversees the Department of Veterans Affairs and cast one of the unanimous votes to subpoena VA records following reports of falsified wait times. Walz said local officials assured him that is not happening here, but he said they did acknowledge that an average of about 2 in every 1,000 veterans in Minnesota had to wait more than 120 days for basic primary care. Walz said that's unacceptable.
We're not satisfied if one person has to wait too long, and we need to strive for that. We may never get perfection. We may never get it, but I think dropping anywhere short of that is a mistake. In trying.
Walz is a National Guard veteran. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A second man has been charged in connection with a weekend fight that left a former Minnesota State Mankato football player critically injured. Elizabeth Baer has more.
Blue Earth County authorities charged 21-year-old Trevor Stenner Shelley of St. Peter with 2 felony assault counts. Earlier this week, similar charges were filed against former U of M quarterback Philip Nelson for the same incident. Assistant Blue Earth County Attorney Pat McDermott says determining which injury caused more damage will be key in this case.
We're waiting for medical documentation so we can review it, and then if we have further follow-up investigation to speak with the medical professionals, the neurosurgeon that has already provided some information, we will determine that at a later date.
24-year-old Isaac Kolstad remains in critical condition at Mayo Clinic Health System in Mankato. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Mankato.
Two Minneapolis men face charges stemming from a shooting and assault on Mother's Day, which could leave a 9-year-old girl permanently blinded in one eye. Here's Brant Williams.
According to charges filed in Hennepin County District Court this week, 20-year-old Miles Estes and 21-year-old DeAndre Hill allegedly assaulted a woman in her car with 4 small children inside in North Minneapolis. Police say Estes threw a brick through the car window and then fired several shots as the woman drove away. The complaint says the girl began screaming that she couldn't see. Police say flying glass damaged one of her eyes so badly she might lose it. Court records show Estes is on conditional release awaiting trial on another gun charge from last year. In an unrelated incident, which also occurred last Sunday in North Minneapolis, a 10-year-old girl was injured by flying glass when a man threw a vodka bottle through the window of a car she was riding in. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The state's online health insurance marketplace will withhold 3.5% of commercial health plan premiums next year to finance its operations. Elizabeth Stawicki reports.
Right now, MinSure retains 1.5% or $1.50 out of every $100 in insurance premiums paid to help generate revenue. But this year, MinSure also has federal grants to help fund operations. Next year, those grants largely dry up, and state-based marketplaces such as MinSure must sustain themselves. MinSure is authorized to withhold 3.5% next year, and board member Tom Forsythe says based on recent enrollment numbers, that's the right course.
We are basically on track on the enrollment expectation.
Updated figures show total MinSure enrollments at about 214,000, with about 50,000 in commercial health plans and the remaining 160,000 in government-sponsored coverage. The board also reelected its same chairman, Brian Buettner, and vice chairman, Pete Benner. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
School teachers in Bloomington have ratified a new 2-year contract that includes a raise and a slightly longer workday. Tim Post with more.
The agreement, approved by both teachers and the school board, includes a 2% raise retroactive to the beginning of this school year and another 2% raise next year. It also includes a one-time $500 payment for 110 teachers with the most seniority. The district has 800 licensed teaching staff. The deal also trims 5 days off next school year in exchange for extending the workday by 12 minutes. Elementary teachers will use the time for professional learning development, Middle and high school teachers will add instructional time. According to the State Teachers Union Education Minnesota, 11% of the state's districts have yet to settle on new two-year contracts. Among the 89% of districts that have settled, the average raise is 2% in each of the 2 years. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Environmental groups and political leaders will participate in a forum in North Minneapolis this evening on how climate change can have a disproportionate impact on communities of color. Here's Elizabeth Dunbar.
The event comes on the heels of the National Climate Assessment. It warns that certain communities are more vulnerable than others to climate change impacts. Those include extreme weather events like major storms and heat waves. The national group Green for All helped organize the event. Executive Director Nikki Silvestri says disasters such as Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy prove that communities of color can suffer more losses.
We're talking about making sure that those who are hit first by these cases of extreme weather and those who are hit worst because they didn't have a lot of infrastructure or economic security to begin with don't get hit the hardest.
Several environmental justice leaders, as well as Congressman Keith Ellison, are scheduled to speak at the event at Kwanzaa Community Church in North Minneapolis. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
State Senator Julianne Ortman of Chanhassen is one of a handful of Republicans competing to challenge U.S. Senator Al Franken in November. She's a former chair of the state Senate Tax Committee, and for the past 10 years, she has represented one of the most conservative legislative districts in the state. But Ortman has had trouble convincing some Republicans she's a true conservative. Catherine Richard reports.
On an unseasonably cold day in early May, Julianne Ortman was warming up a crowd of potential supporters at a Tea Party Express rally.
We're going to say keep more of your hard-earned income.
Change your senator.
I knew it. How about keep your doctor?
Ortman says she won't continue her campaign to challenge Franken unless delegates endorse her at the Republican convention later this month. So right now, Ortman is making the case to party loyalists that she's a true conservative. But that might be a tough job. In the past, Ortman has had trouble convincing Republicans who know her best that she's with them on taxes, same-sex marriage, and a host of other issues. In 2012, Republicans in her district didn't endorse her for re-election to the Senate. Ortman says her endorsement trouble may have stemmed from her legislative style, which she says focuses on listening and consensus.
Some people wanted to say that I wasn't conservative or conservative enough. And I say I'm conservative, I'm just not angry.
Bruce Schwichtenberg is a Chaska auto mechanic who challenged Ortman for the Republican Party nomination for state Senate in 2012. He has a different take on her record.
On paper, it looks good, because being the tax committee chair, but again, I go back and I look at what's been going on since they were in the majority, and the conservative type of leadership hasn't been there.
Ortman opposes same-sex marriage, but Schwichtenberg said her record on the issue is fuzzy, pointing to a 2010 committee hearing where Ortman said she was happy that the public's opinion of same-sex couples was shifting.
I don't know when the majority of Minnesotans will switch, will change, will support your views. I don't know that. But I know minds and hearts are changing on this issue every single day. And it's a great relief to me.
Carver County Republican Party official Jeff Catherman said Ortman's record on tax policy is also confusing because of the tax bills that she's proposed.
I think she sometimes has a record of being a little bit inconsistent, and you don't quite know what she's going to be really pushing for and what she won't be. And she's just not as aggressive as some of the local conservative activists would like her to be.
In 2011, Ortman said she would consider cutting spending on tax loopholes to help balance the state's budget. Among the Republicans who are concerned about that approach was former Senate Majority Leader Amy Koch.
The concern for a lot of conservatives, and frankly the concern that I had, was that one person's closing of a loophole is another person's tax increase.
For her part, Ortman said any tax proposal she considered was part of being a good legislator.
And so it's important to have policy conversations. And that's the part I mean about being principled and effective. No, I won't vote to raise anyone's taxes, but I will push forward ideas to talk about how do we accomplish our goals of having the users pay for government as opposed to high income taxes for everybody.
Now the question is whether those moderate moments in Ortman's largely conservative record will matter to party loyalists when it comes time to endorse a candidate. Her supporters are quick to point out that she won her district's 2012 primary and re-election. And Ortman came out on top of this year's GOP caucus straw poll. 23rd Congressional District Republican Party co-chair Rick Weibel said he noticed at a hastily announced party event earlier this year that Ortman's campaign was better organized than others.
Ortman was there the entire time, ready to speak. Campaign signs were up, and especially for a short notice, that was impressive.
But even if Ortman wins the endorsement, she'll have to face off against Mike McFadden, a wealthy businessman who's planning to compete in the primary no matter what happens at the party convention. Right now, McFadden has the fundraising advantage. But what Ortman says she lacks in cash, she's making up for in people who will work and vote for her.
Kat Richard on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Well, it's only May, but already 2014 is shaping up as a busy year in Minneapolis city government. The seven freshman members of the city council wasted no time in exercising their newfound power, and they have occasionally gotten burned as they learned the ropes at City Hall. Here's Curtis Gilbert.
The most controversial move so far this year was the moratorium the city council placed on building new houses in five southwest Minneapolis neighborhoods. Some residents there were concerned about giant monster homes, and they were fed up with constant construction. The moratorium was initially scheduled to last up to a year, but after a month, the council lifted it. That followed furious opposition from businesses and residents who denounced it as government overreach.
The message this sends to anyone who wants to move into Minneapolis is incredibly negative.
I think it's a blunt, heavy-handed instrument that's indiscriminate in its application.
The real estate market is a china shop, and this measure is a bull.
Newly elected council member Lene Palmisano sponsored the moratorium. She says it succeeded in bringing builders to the bargaining table and resulted in new rules aimed at keeping contractors conscientious, even if it left her with some battle scars.
Well, it sort of feels like you're standing in front of a train, and to some extent you know what you're getting into, right? It's always hard to take, but it's why I love my job. As a mentor of mine once told me, who has been around the city for a long time, she said, you don't lead to be loved all the time.
At 37, Palmisano is one of the oldest members of the council's freshman class. Andrew Johnson is the youngest. He's 29. With a background in information technology, he's been pushing to make the city's databases available online. And armed with data, he's raised questions about how long it takes the city to answer 911 calls. But Johnson says he's found some people at City Hall are uncomfortable airing those issues in public.
I think occasionally there's this mentality of you don't want something to embarrass the city of Minneapolis. And to me, I'm not here to make the city of Minneapolis look good, to make the government look good. I'm here to stand up for my constituents.
Johnson has also been publicly scolded by some senior council members for violating parliamentary customs, but he hasn't let it get him down.
There are so many different things to get involved with and so many passionate people you run into. And what's not to love about that? It's such a fun job.
I don't think you could describe this as fun.
Councilmember Blong Yang is also in his first term, and he's found the work less a joy than a burden, with an endless succession of meetings. Earlier this year, Yang found himself on the losing side of a fight over the city's civil rights department. Two former employees testified civil rights director Velma Korbel created a hostile work environment. Yang, who also used to work for Korbel, said those accusations didn't surprise him, and he voted not to confirm her for a second term. But Yang couldn't marshal enough votes to block the nomination.
I don't think anybody wants to be in city council and lose on votes, but I'd rather lose and keep my values or principles than vote to win just to win.
Minneapolis hasn't had this many first-term council members since 2002. That class took office during the post-9/11 recession. Council President Barbara Johnson says its agenda was dominated by painful budget cuts.
You know, you'd wake up in the middle of the night and think, I'm going to have to lay off firefighters. That's draining, and so it does take away from your thinking about more extraneous things.
Johnson notes that this year, the council renamed Columbus Day as Indigenous Peoples Day. It's also mandated nightclubs give out free earplugs, and it's in the process of banning plastic foam food containers from restaurants. President Johnson, who served on the council since 1997, says new members need to learn that people pay attention to what they're doing, and that reflects on the city.
I think that there are a lot of people who are watching us and saying, what is important?
Johnson says she's shared those concerns with the new members, and she's hoping she can head off what she calls the really fringy stuff, before it makes the news.
Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis. Developers are pumping $2.5 billion in private and public money into the areas along the new Green Line light rail system. That's according to the agency building the line, the Metropolitan Council. Laura Ewan reports.
More than half of the projects involve some kind of housing, ranging from student rentals to luxury high-rises. Among the new urbanites eager to live close to light rail are senior citizens.
We're adding another 168 units to our main campus here at Fairview and University.
Marvin Plackett is CEO of Episcopal Homes on St. Paul's western edge of University Avenue. Behind him, the bones of a new building are rising from a patch of dirt. He says the new development is almost fully leased out, even though it won't open for another 6 months.
The majority of residents that are wanting to get on our wait list at this time, they're saying they want to do so because light rail is stopping just a few feet away from our front door. So we're delighted about our location. We feel like we couldn't be luckier to have this location here in St. Paul where we have been for over a century.
The Met Council is keeping track of 121 projects they say are planned, under construction, or are already built. Council staff compiled the list from news stories and building permits, among other sources. They say the investment far exceeds the amount of development along the Hiawatha Corridor, or the Blue Line, which runs from downtown Minneapolis to the airport and Mall of America. While some projects on the Green Line list may never get built, Council Chairwoman Sue Haig says she believes the $2.5 billion estimate is conservative. It doesn't include the price tags of projects where the developers have yet to disclose their investment figures.
We expect that this is just the beginning of the development. We'll continue to see more development as we open that line and there's more interest in the development opportunities along it.
Many of the projects are clustered in the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And no surprise, the biggest investment of all is a $400 million mixed-use project that just broke ground near the new Minnesota Vikings Stadium. But there are smaller bricks-and-mortar jobs peppered into the mix. Omar Ansari, who heads the Surly Brewing Company, says it was essential for him to locate his $20 million destination brewery near transit, particularly light rail. He envisions a day when beer enthusiasts from Elk River will hop onto the North Star commuter rail and then catch the Green Line to his brewery a few blocks from University Avenue. Same goes for out-of-towners who choose to ride the rails from the airport to Surly to quench their thirst.
So it's great for us just because, you know, people will happen to have a beer when they come out to our place, and we want to give people as many ways to get home as they can without driving.
And he's not alone in that desire. Surly is one of four breweries that have announced plans to set up shop or redevelop within a half mile of the Green Line. Ansari says that concentration will turn the Central Corridor into a convenient craft beer circuit.
You can take the light rail from brewery to brewery, or nice ride it, or take your bike, or walk, or any of those things. I think that density of breweries is a great thing for a town's beer scene.
While Ansari is focused on hops, Gretchen Nichols is keen on housing, particularly affordable housing that can keep low-income families in the corridor. She's a program officer with Twin Cities LISC. While some critics have complained that the area has become oversaturated with affordable housing, Nichols says that's not the case. A report released by her group this week found that just 7% of all new units in the corridor are considered affordable.
So this already is a place where there's a lot of low-income people. So the question is, do we want all those people to leave here and go somewhere else? What I think is good is we're having a healthy debate about it.
Meanwhile, projects across Minneapolis and St. Paul forge ahead.
Laura Ewan on the NPR News Update. A bitter online tirade about Minneapolis-based Target struggles from someone identified as a company employee is creating a stir. The diatribe prompted an extraordinary public response from the retailer's chief marketing officer, and that too is creating a buzz. Martin Moylan has more.
Last week, the Gawker website posted a rambling critique from someone the site identified as, quote, a current mid-level employee at Target's headquarters. The 1,200-word rant chastised Target for a wide range of alleged wrongs, from being stingy with vacation time to eroding employee productivity by having the troops spend too much time in meetings and company and volunteer events. The commentary said Target's culture is very passive-aggressive. Quote, they expect you to conform to them, to be targetized. If you aren't super bubbly, super social, and passive aggressive, you get told you're a problem. The critics said the departure of former CEO Greg Steinhoffel was a good start, but the entire executive team needs to go, with the exception of Chief Marketing Officer Jeff Jones. It was Jones who responded, sending an email to employees at Target's headquarters and then publicly posting the missive on LinkedIn. Veteran crisis management expert James Lukaszewski found that surprising.
If I were advising him, I'd say, let it pass.
Lukaszewski says Jones' response directs attention to Gawker and other material that criticizes and sometimes mocks the retailer.
He was the only person named in this document. And he was actually named in a very positive way. The writer recommended everybody be fired at the top except him. So, I think he saw his name and he got mad.
Target said Jones was not available for comment, but his message has been well received by employees. In his message, Jones said the truth hurts and Target has suffered a lot lately. He noted the massive theft of customer data the company endured just before Christmas, and earlier this month, Steinhoffel stepped down in the wake of the data breach, Target's huge losses in Canada, and lackluster performance of late in the U.S. Jones said he was angry when he read the employee's post and other online comments and wondered why, quote, any team member would say what they said. But he said, quote, much of what they are saying is true. With hard work, he said, Target can turn itself around. But he said the gist of conversations he's had with his marketing leaders is, quote, if you are too tired or too cynical for this work, please leave.
It's very untargety.
Communications and crisis management consultant John Austin said Jones' response doesn't mesh with Target's history of deliberate, cautious responses when it comes to the company's brand and business affairs. He said it's generally prudent for companies to ignore most criticisms leveled at them on the internet. But Austin said Jones' action could be a good move.
If he was trying to talk to the Target audience, the Target employees, in a way that would get their attention and provoke a discussion and send, you know, the meta message of a company that's open and willing to have discussions like this out in public, maybe that's an interesting tactic.
But Austin says there's another way to look at the response. Jones took Gawker's bait.
Gawker lives with the hope that somebody will take notice of whatever it is they posted that day and start a conversation, and they're really, really good at provoking those things.
Retail consultant Carol Speakerman said Jones made a number of good points.
I think he was messaging that some of this criticism, you know, shouldn't be just thrown out, you know, out of hand, that there might be some gems of value there that they need to address and that are true.
But Speakerman said Jones should not have let his remarks be seen as a response to the Gawker post.
He could have accomplished the same benefit through a proactive post rather than doing it in response to an anonymous disgruntled employee's rant.
Despite the surprisingly public outburst from a Target executive, one thing remains hidden inside the company, whether Jones is a candidate to become CEO and whether his actions will help or hurt his chances of winning the top job.
Martin Moylan there from the business desk. Phase two of the clinical trials testing a new treatment for cancer could begin early this fall. The journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings reported this week a woman with a type of blood cancer known as multiple myeloma went into remission after being injected with a huge dose of a re-engineered measles vaccine. It's believed to be the first time using a virus to attack cancer cells has been successful in a human. It will take a lot more research to determine if this is an effective treatment, and the Mayo Clinic in Rochester will be looking for more people to participate in trials. Coordinator Tony K. Mangskow talked with Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition.
When there's a news story like the one in the Star Tribune yesterday about this interesting development, do you often hear from folks who want to participate in the trials?
I do. Mayo Clinic, our research is very much global, so I receive phone calls from people all around the world that may hear a new story, or maybe one of our physicians or researchers is presenting at an international or national conference, and our phones start ringing.
What do you usually tell folks when they call?
And so when someone calls us, we collect a little bit of demographic information, their name and phone number, how we can contact them. And then we're going to collect information on what is their diagnosis and have they had any treatment. When people provide that information to us initially, we can go into a database and we can look for any potential clinical trials for that patient.
We have probably at any one time about 300 actively enrolling studies for all cancer types.
But not everyone would qualify.
That's correct. So when we talk to someone, we're looking for a little bit more information so that we can do an initial triage. And you can't confirm over the phone that someone's going to be eligible because we're not looking at someone's lab work. We're not looking at some scans like a CAT scan or a PET scan. And so ultimately it would involve coming to a study site location like Mayo Clinic and meeting with one of the specialists. And you want to look at the medical records and meet the person to where you're seeing them in front of you.
The story in the Star Tribune was very interesting, as I mentioned. This was a Pequot Lakes woman who had an advanced form of multiple myeloma with this huge dose of measles vaccine. She now evidently is in remission, and that has a lot of people talking. But this trial's only made it through phase one, so it's pretty early. What does that mean exactly?
Sure. So most medications or treatments, they're studied for about 6 or 7 years in the laboratory before they're used with humans. And so once a medication or a treatment is being used with a participant, it's known as a phase one clinical trial. And a phase one study is trying to figure out the best way to give a treatment and also to establish a dose of the treatment. So sometimes you hear phase one studies referred to as dosing studies. And if there are some positive results in a phase one clinical trial, the decision could be made to move forward to a phase two study. And that's where we're at with this measles virus study. In a phase two clinical trial, you're looking at how effective is a treatment. And you tune into the side effects. If there are positive findings in a phase two study, the decision could be made to move forward to a phase three clinical trial.
Okay.
A phase three clinical trial is sometimes it's a larger study, and you compare the standard treatment to the new treatment. So when someone is newly diagnosed, that's when their slate is clean, and that's probably the best time to be looking to participate in a clinical trial because you would have access to those phase three studies. If someone has already had standard treatments, they're probably not going to be eligible for a phase three study.
Good information, Tony K. Manskow. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tony K. Manskow and Kathy Werzer for us on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi on Twitter at PicardiMPR. John Wanamaker has the podcast tomorrow. Come back again for the Friday news.